You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it, people who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God does there. I'm your host, Joe Epley, and this week we're going to be leaning into kind of a format that we've been pursuing the last several months, where we kind of alternate, right, between an interview of a rural leader, kind of traditional to what this podcast has been, and then really taking an episode where I, as the host, get to walk you through a rural resource, right? And this week, we're going to be looking at the book, A Big Gospel in Small Places, Why Ministry in Forgotten Communities Matters, by Stephen Whitmer, right? And so I picked up this book recently, super excited to check it out. Obviously, anytime there's a title with rural ministry in the name, it definitely gets me going. And so as I usually do, I just kind of want to walk through this with you. If you read this book, if you choose to buy it, I think you're going to have different takeaways, different highlights, different things that matter to you. But you're going to hear some of my thoughts on why I love this book and why I think you should read it. And it all kind of starts with a quote that's in the very beginning of the book, right, where we kind of get the author's heartbeat. He says this: "All grandiosity offends God, especially ministry grandiosity. But all humility pleases God, especially ministry humility. We who serve the Lord are following an egoless nobody named Jesus who had no itch for prominent big dealness. He is why small towns can be ideal settings for God's greatest blessings." I love this viewpoint on rural because, again, sometimes we sit in a rural context and we go, well, why am I here? What's going on? Or what's the value here? And it is important to remember that the way Jesus lived his life kind of lends itself to the rural ideal, right? This idea that Jesus wasn't looking for big things in that same sense. Obviously, no one can diminish the mission that Jesus lived out. But he wasn't at the center of political or community power. He was in the backwater province of Judea doing his thing, you know? And I think for us as rural ministers, it is so important for us to internalize that message of who Jesus is. Another thing I think of, or what I love about this quote, is immediately following this quote, right? He says, "I'm not proposing that large cities are only for arrogant pastors and small towns are for humble ones." And I love what we're going to see throughout this book is that Stephen is very good as an author about remaining balanced, right? About not getting too excited about rurals to the point where he kind of gets to the expense of the large church, if you will. And again, that's something we always want to guard against. I want to see gospel beauty in all places. Now, obviously, I get the luxury of kind of focusing in on rural church and saying, how do we speak to this? But truthfully, we should train ourselves to say, God, whatever the context is that I'm witnessing, how can I see your gospel impact everywhere that I go? So to that point, he kind of lays out a good plan for the book, and he says this: "In the pages that follow, I'll seek to answer three questions that correspond with the book's three main sections. First, what are small places like? Second, how can we minister fruitfully in small places? And third, should I minister in a small place?" And we'll get into this later. But I do truly respect his ability to think critically about whether or not people should go pastor in small places. I think sometimes, despite our best efforts, we end up having a misfit, if you will. And I think it's important as ministers to think, man, should I be pursuing this ministry in this place, in this context? So just kind of thumbing through again, how I usually do it is just find places in the book I really love and we just talk through them. Very informally. Well, again, mentioning what I just talked about, one of my favorite one-liner quotes from this book, he's in the middle of talking about the importance of small places, the importance of rural places, urban places. He's just saying like, hey, we have to have a theological intentional vision for loving the places we minister. And he says this single line, it's very short but very powerful. He says, "We cannot serve what we despise." And I think that's important for us because, again, some of us may, whether we want to or not, resent being in a small town. We may go, God, why am I here or what am I doing or what are you trying to accomplish in this season? And that can be a problem because if you're trying to effectively minister to people in your town, it's going to be much harder to do that if we don't have an inherent love for them. But we can also flip this coin any direction we want, because truthfully, if you're a small town, frequently you might come across a large church pastor. You might have another church in town that has more people than yours. And ultimately, our call as ministers of the gospel is not just to serve the church, but to serve our fellow brothers and sisters, to serve other pastors, other ministers, to be friends with them, to be close to them, to kind of strengthen the body of Christ. And if we are so busy throwing stones at models of ministry that are not our favorite or that might grow differently than ours, we have to watch out, because I think it's going to actually kind of flip back on us. We cannot serve. We cannot take the posture of Jesus if we're too busy in our hearts despising the context that we're either serving in or interacting with. And so I thought that was a good admonition near the beginning of the book. But as he gets into what rural places are like, right, one of the perspectives that I was so excited he chose to tackle, because I didn't really have words for it before this point, but I've always been aware of what happens when people kind of idealize rural from the outside, right? Or if they put down rural from the outside, right? Like, if somebody is on the outside looking into rural, I am already prepared to kind of be on the defensive, right? I'm already prepared to say, hey, you haven't lived here. You don't know what it's like. Take your big seat ideas and move on. And that's a proclivity that I'm always constantly working to overcome. For all of us, I think that we're so worried about that side of things. You know, we're so kind of sometimes focused on this idea of like, man, I wish people, you know, respected the context in which I minister. I wish I didn't have to adhere or endure these comments that are made to me. So he points out very knowingly, you know, hey, we have a certain danger here that we don't want to get down on ourselves because people put us down from the outside. But what he does that I have not had words for before is he then flips it on the rural pastor. And he says, hey, for as much as you should not ever endorse the myth of your own inferiority, you should also never use these external put-downs or this external feeling of being less than to justify or reinforce the myth of our own superiority. Now, let me break down what the author means by that. Basically, what he's saying is sometimes, because we're so worried that someone's going to look down on our small town that we minister, when we are so worried that you know, they're going to disregard a place that we care deeply about, sometimes we do the opposite. We get so proud of our own context that it actually causes us to throw out good ideas, good influences, good friendships, truly needed input from outside sources. At the end of the day, I don't want to grow because something's a rural resource or an urban one. I don't want to grow just because, by picking and choosing my sources. I just want to take everything in my life, whether it's coming from a quote-unquote outsider, an insider, whether it comes through introspection or a book that I've read, whether it comes with the right heart and the right spirit or not, but whatever comes into my sphere as a leader, I want to grow from it. And in my role currently in ministry, I have had the privilege to attend large churches, rural churches, and every time I do, I'm just reminded of the beauty of the gospel in each of those places, not at the expense of one another, but just truly inherently, there's beauty and things to learn. Honestly, one of the crazy things that I enjoy about this book is that this book really does, the more you read it, you kind of go, wait a second, maybe we're actually all seeking the same goal, right? Like, I think it would be easy for this author to zone in and be like, well, here's what rural does better than this, or compare and contrast. But truthfully, he says this following statement, and I love it because we're always trying to figure out how we evaluate success in ministry, right? Like, that's always a question. So he says this. He says, what if our criteria for evaluating ministry success included see-through ability to God? What if we consider this question? How is our church uniquely contributing to the universe-wide display of God's character expressed in the gospel of Christ? What does this look like? And he applies it to everybody. He says, man, this can apply. This question should be asked in a big place, in a small place, in a medium place, in a place that feels forgotten, in a place that doesn't. Doesn't matter where we're at. I want to work in ministry to give God glory, right? The source of small-town ministry is the gospel, and the goal is the glory of God. And so as we dive into kind of strategic and really in this section of the book, he talks a lot about like what are the mindsets and the ways in which you do small-town ministry. But that is a good thing to keep in mind, right? Kind of moving through, again, he goes into this section that's very practical, very pragmatic. And what I love is so often I think in rural we get caught up on this idea of how hard the context is, as we should. You know, there is still a part of me that goes, man, it's kind of tough sometimes to minister in these out-of-the-way places. However, I do love when an author says, yeah, but here's why it's easier. Here's why there's something to rejoice in, something to be excited about, because the way that you're going to interact with what I'm about to say is like so exciting. It makes it more fun, right? So he says this. He says, the smallness of your small place means that you'll be recognized around town even if you make a minimal effort just to be present. And I really enjoy that because that was kind of lining up with some of my own experience. You know, I moved to a town of 1,200, trying to be a youth pastor, doing all these things. And what I found, and people would say, oh, wow, Joe, I love the growth that you're experiencing. That's so cool. And over time, the more successful you are, the more kind of visibility you do get with certain people. Somebody might say, oh, great job. What's your secret? And I'm like, actually, some days I just kind of feel like it's not actually that hard. And please, that is not a tooting my own horn. What I was trying to communicate to people was like, in some ways, a small town lends itself towards putting in some basic efforts to be present with people. And I think growth will come from that because they'll sense that you care. And so in some ways, I celebrate that there's at least something about a small town that doesn't feel just inherently like an uphill battle. There's a story he shares, and this is kind of challenging a pastor's vision, right? Like kind of this idea of, pastor, are you ministering in your small place, trusting that God will do whatever he wants to do, right? Because again, I think that the wind and the waves of life buffet us, right? They crash into us and say, hey, you know, maybe you dream big for too long and you get knocked down and nothing comes from it. Or maybe you have dreamed big for too long, got knocked down, and you go, well, I'm only dreaming small dreams. And he shares a story from a rural practitioner, right? Someone who was rural coming out of history, right? We're talking the Great Awakening. We're talking England. We're talking the 1700s. And there was this guy named William Grimshaw, right? And he was in this small town. Okay, we're talking a small church, small place, 2,000 residents in this town of Haworth, or however the British probably say it. But it says that he came to this very small church, and his goal was to, like, love the Lord. He just was gripped. It says he was gripped by the gospel. He preached clear sermons and began visiting his parishioners in their home. And suddenly his ministry began to have this effect. God chose to use his ministry to grow. You know, there was 120 people that got saved. Then there were hundreds of people. Then there were thousands of people. And eventually people like John and Charles Wesley, George Whitefield were preaching in his pulpit. There was this insane, remarkable revival, right? And this is what the author writes in light of Mr. Grimshaw's success. He says, though Mr. Grimshaw often preached to great numbers, he was no less attentive, a servant of the few. When any were willing to hear, he was willing to preach, and often cheerfully walked miles in the storms of wind, rain, or snow to preach to a small company of aged, decrepit people in a cottage. His lesson from this story is this story should inspire us to both dream big, but to also be no less content if God gives us something small to watch over and pastor. Ah, what a healthy reminder for us as people. Continuing on, this makes a case for longevity. That's a subject that's near and dear to my heart. The idea of, you know, what can we accomplish when we stay in one place for a long time? And this is a quote he says. He says, there's these two guys, I'm assuming studiers, you know, Ron Klassen and John Kostler. And they identify the rapid turnover of pastors in small town churches as one reason why many of these churches always remain in survival mode. He says the perpetual search for a new pastor makes it difficult to plan for the future. Also, over time, pastoral mobility, meaning one to another to another to another, decreases pastoral influence. Particularly in small communities, respect is the critical aspect of community leadership. And sometimes when we flip, and the church goes through it, what's happening is as each pastor turns over in a short amount of time, the church's respect in the community can plummet, and it can make it really hard to reach and connect with people. And so I understand there's a million circumstances that might not allow us to stay kind of a long term in a place, but I just want to challenge you. Just want to pray with you and encourage you to say, hey, whenever you can, see if you can passionately, intentionally stick it out. Because I think that the dividends of respect of gospel opportunity are just going to keep growing. He continues on in this kind of, you know, how do we minister fruitfully in small places, right? How do we make it work? And he talks about joy killers, right? Things that take away your joy. He talks about discontent, envy, those kind of things. And really, one of the ways that he says battling these things like envy, he says what you should do is pursue friendship, right? He talks about envy isolating and feeding on isolation. He says it's difficult to grow a genuine friendship with those who trigger our feelings of inadequacy or discontent. So this is what he says. When we're not in genuine relationship with those we envy, we won't actually love and rejoice with them in their successes. Neither will we see their real struggles and insecurities. Instead, we'll spin our own distorted narrative of the complex realities and hardships of that other person's life. They won't even matter. It turns out the best way to kill envy is friendship. And so he continues to kind of talk about this idea of pursuing friendship. And I think this is heavily adequate for a small town, right? He talks about this idea that you don't want to be in competition with people. Instead, you want to get excited. You want to be able to rejoice, to truly walk with other people. And by doing that, as much as it's scary, as much as it triggers our insecurities, when we do that, we actually become a ton healthier. And I love this reflective prayer, right? Like he talks about fear of failure. And this sentence, I mean, gosh, if this doesn't strike a chord in your heart as a rural pastor, I guess when I read this quote that I'm about to read to you, the question that came to my mind was how many hundreds of times do we kind of have to hear this thought before we finally let it sink in, right? Because I've read this in almost every single book I've read about rural church, and it hits me again in a fresh way. He says this, "I'm sad to say that over the years, Sunday morning attendance has had too great a hold on my heart, my self-image, and my mood." And gosh, I just think, man, rural pastor, rural leader, if you're out there saying, man, I'm struggling with that, I'm like, man, can we work hard to like let this go? Can we think it through in a way that helps us move past it, move beyond it, right? So then in the third section of this book, again, what one of my favorite pieces of this is that he starts to examine the idea of should you minister in a small place, which kudos to him, because truthfully, I think that there are some real reasons to minister in a small town, and there's some real reasons not to. And I think sometimes people come to small towns with not necessarily bad intentions, but they might say, oh, I'm moving to a small town because of this effect in ministry, and they might be disappointed by bad expectations. Or someone says, yeah, I'm going to move to a big place with these expectations, and it's like, hey, at the end of the day, can we try and do things for the right gospel reason? For example, he says this statement, again, good with words. He says, neither inertia's tug, meaning I don't want to leave my small town because I've been here forever, nor ambition's pull, meaning I've got an opportunity and now I'm going to leave my small town. He says, neither of them lead to the confident joy and kingdom effectiveness of God's call. Neither inertia's tug nor ambition's pull lead to the confident joy and kingdom effectiveness of God's call. Whether you stay in your small place or leave it, he says, I pray it will be because you're persuaded it's what God wants. And man, if that's not an encouragement to rural pastors everywhere to say, hey, think deeply. When we're praying, we don't want to just leave at the next opportunity. We don't want to just stay because staying's easier. Like, let's have an intentional vision of I know I'm where God is asking me to be in my small town. He has this section where it says, some good reasons not to minister in small places, why we shouldn't go. One of the sections he titles, it's super fun. He says, there's bad reasons not to minister in small places and good reasons not to minister in small places. And he just kind of looks through, and again, I encourage you to read it for yourself, but he talks about these kind of one-liners, you know. I want to make a name for myself, so I must be called to a bigger place. And it's like, well, that's not a good reason not to go to a small town. You know, small place ministry is too difficult, or there's not enough good coffee shops, right? And he talks a lot about these kind of things that we tell ourselves. And truth be told, what I think the author is trying to help us understand is that at the end of the day, we should go because God calls us, and we don't want to let these kind of smokescreen things keep us from either going or not going. Like, let's get it settled in our heart, right? He kind of starts to, he actually takes a whole nother chapter in this section to kind of talk through common reasons why people prioritize big place ministry, right? And there's a lot of good missiology in here. You know, he talks about how a lot of times people go to cities because it's strategic, right? And it helps establish big city churches because then they reach the surrounding areas. You know, he talks about early historical reason, the Apostle Paul travels around, you know, like how that as Christianity and missiology have developed, that we've kind of had this theology of the big city. But in the middle of that, he starts to emerge with a picture, right? As he's talking about, here's all the reasons why people have prioritized big place ministry and maybe forgotten rural ministry, he starts to paint a picture. And it's not one that, again, pits the rural and urban as adversaries. Instead, he starts to say, how can we learn from one another? And one of the ways that he talks about rural influencing urban is he says, small place ministers are shaping small place young people. And often these small place young people are going to leave and go influence big place churches. And we can resent that, we can get frustrated by it, or we can look at it as our opportunity to say, can I continue to ground these young people in gospel values within the context of small town church and community in a way that makes them the best asset for the church they're going to attend? What a selfless vision of rural church. If I know that I'm going to be raising up young people predominantly to send them off to urban contexts or bigger places, how much more should I rejoice that from my church, as a rural pastor, I get the privilege of sending someone out into the world to affect the gospel in other places that's being packaged in the values of the church they grew up in, right? He says this, we can influence big places from small ones. And I think that's such a healthy attitude. Our goal should not be to say, oh man, I trained up this leader and we sent him to college and they never came back. Instead, we should say, man, I hope that they are a deacon at this church eventually. I hope they're going and serving on their worship teams. I hope that all the years we spent training them on sound benefits them in the new place. And that can be a tough mentality. But man, if that doesn't put some fire in my heart to do this in a way that is strong, right? In a way that is so valuing to both contexts. And finally, he uses this example to close out the book that I think is, again, important to remember for this both and kind of conversation. We love rural, not at the expense of big places. How do we learn from them? How do they learn from us? How do we glean from one another, right? And he talks about revelation, right, which can always be very interesting, you know. But he says, in revelation, and he's quoting another author, but he says, in revelation, we see that the ultimate ideal place, the dwelling place of God, is actually the garden city, right? There's this city, the New Jerusalem, that comes down from heaven. It is urban. It is big. If you read the dimensions, I'm like confused as how a big city like that would work, which I think is the point. It's revelation. It's hard to understand, you know. It's in God's hands, if you will. But in the middle of the city is a river and the trees of life, right? And there's the fruit of the tree of life on either side of the river flowing through the middle of the city. And you see this kind of ultimate marriage of city and garden, of rural and urban, right? And what he says is, John's vision is of a garden city. And the garden part isn't less important than the city part. John sees our future as a rural-urban future in which countryside and city mingle for the good of both and the blessing of all. So again, as a final note, I just really encourage you to read this book. I thought the one-liners that lifted my own soul, that encouraged my journey and the ministry work I'm trying to do, were phenomenal. I thought that his map of saying, hey, what are small towns like? How can we be practical? And then how do I take healthy stock of whether I should be ministering in a small place or not? How do I reignite the vision of my heart towards obedience instead of any superficial reason? Was such a healthy, healthy way to look at the gospel in small places. In addition to that, and I've said it before and I'll probably say it again, I have seen too much beauty in all parts of the body of Christ, big and small, to ever live in a world where we get to put down a part of the body of Christ to lift our own up. And I love, love, love that this book says it is not rural or urban, it is rural and urban. And while we zone in with a magnifying glass on the part that applies directly to us, we need to spend more of our time exploring the ways in which we are meant to collaborate and cooperate, not looking for reasons to break partnership. Is that an easy road? No, absolutely not. Is it simple to understand, though? Absolutely. With a clear objective, with a potential partnership on the horizon, I just encourage you to dive into this book. I think it'll bless you. Again, it is A Big Gospel in Small Places by Stephen Whitmer. We will have a link in the show notes. But I want to say thank you for joining us for a rural resource this week. As you know, we are alternating, so I look forward to next time for you getting to hear an interview from a rural practitioner. We'll see you in a couple weeks for that one. But again, our goal with this podcast is that you be strengthened, encouraged, equipped, that you feel like you are ready to do ministry in a small place. Once again, I encourage you in a very pragmatic sense, check out our website, ruraladvancement.com. You can find the podcast there, other resources. Check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcast. I've been your host, Joe Epley, and we'll see you next time.